I'd like to also thank everybody. It's an absolutely beautiful day out there in Seattle, and it's probably would have been better for it to be rainy, but thank you all for coming indoors and giving me an opportunity to speak. You know, one of the reasons why this event might not be as well known out there is because it almost didn't happen. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about what I think would be useful for us to do in order to face these pretty severe injustice issues. Like everybody here in the States, I think was raised with the same kind of understanding: my nation is the greatest in the world, and freedom and democracy, and all this kind of stuff. I think, like most people as well, I took that to heart. I believed it to be true. And in that context, I joined the Marine Corps when I was 19 years old. I was actually quite conservative or Republican in those days. And so joining the Marine Corps, I actually enjoyed it for the most part. A year into my service, I was a model Marine. I knew my job extremely well. I actually thrived under the kind of challenging situations that the Marines do put you in. And about a year into it, however, I ended up speaking out on something. I took many of the principles of the Marine Corps, at least the branded, marketed idea of the Marine Corps, seriously, one of which was honor and integrity and leadership by example, which is something that I firmly believe in. Anyway, my leaders were not leading by example, and I did what's a cardinal sin in the Marine Corps. I jumped my chain of command. I went around them, and I reported what they were doing to their superiors. They were promptly told to discontinue their behavior, and it was sent down. The question was, who did this? And again, going back to honor and integrity, I felt that it was necessary for me to say publicly or to own up to what I had said. From that point forward, my life became extremely difficult, to say the least. This is not like having a boss in the civilian world who doesn't like you. This is about having effectively a slave master who can tell you to do virtually anything, and if you have a problem with it, there's not going to be any kind of, interim board or something to go and appeal the decision to. It's very difficult. If you've ever seen the movie Full Metal Jacket, you'll have an idea of how things work in the Marine Corps when you're being targeted. You might recall, if you have seen the movie, Private Pyle was being punished by the drill instructor and repeatedly punished and punished and punished. And eventually the drill instructor used a different tactic and punished the entire platoon. But the whole platoon knew the reason why they were being punished was because of Private Pyle. And the same tactic was used against me. I learned out very quickly how many friends I had, and it wasn't that many. And I had to look over my shoulder continuously. And this was a really horrendous experience. At the time, I didn't enjoy it at all. But it is the best thing that ever happened to me. And the reason why is because it was my first real taste of injustice. This is nothing compared to what people are dealing with on so many levels in so many different parts of the world. But for me, it was a terrible injustice. I had done the right thing, and now I'm getting punished for it, and quite severely, to the point that I have to look over my shoulder, and being on a ship, I might get thrown overboard. Things like this happen. So I had reason to believe that my life was in danger. That taste of injustice was absolutely imperative for my development. I was still ignorant at that time. I didn't really know anything about American foreign policy. I didn't have any highly developed understanding of any of the issues really around the world. I was still stupid, quite frankly. Yeah, and the beauty of being that stupid is that when I see my brothers and sisters in America being stupid, I can see myself. You know, because I have develop the capacity to actually think for myself once again and see the world for what it is, I shouldn't expect that everyone else do this in unison. That would be rather arrogant. So, you know, of course I would very much appreciate and love to see Americans start to be able to think for themselves and actually take the ideal of America and make it the reality of America, the greatest nation in the world. But, you know, I don't look down on people who are ignorant and stupid, and I can easily say that about myself, because I do see myself in such people. I can say the same thing about the Israelis as well. As hostile and arrogant and violent and nasty as they are, I can even imagine myself in that circumstance if I were raised with that kind of indoctrination and this kind of belief that God is ordained for you to have all of these things and everyone that stands in your way is this, that, or the other. I mean, indoctrination is a most powerful thing. Very, very powerful. I say the real reason why we have these problems is because of the indoctrination that breeds the kind of ignorance and stupidity that allows us to be manipulated and used over and over and over again. And I'm not the smartest guy in the world by any stretch, but when you can actually think for yourself, it is amazing how it transforms your ability to see the world. And you can see the transparently false, corrupt nature of our world virtually across the board, whether it's the mainstream media, whether it's the scientific areas of our world, the academic institutions, across the spectrum, you can see, and ironically, I think, you know, some of the most stupid people on the planet are Harvard, Oxford, and Cambridge graduates because they've had to go through even more indoctrination and effectively jump through all the hoops and do all the backflips to get the piece of paper on the wall and effectively carry on the system that allows this kind of terrible injustice to continue. Let us not forget that the invasion of Iraq had a whole host of experts who said, well, we need to for this reason, we need to for that reason. It's the best science money can buy, and the same thing works throughout the academic institutions and whatnot. We live in a world, effectively, where the monetary system, which really, if we want to get to the root of the problem, we must look at the monetary system. I mean, the Federal Reserve is staring us right in the face. How is it possible? And I'm not going to get too far off track here. I'm going to get back where we're going. But nonetheless, this is giving you an idea of how I see the world and why it's going the way it is. The Federal Reserve System is staring us right in the face. The filthy, rich, moneyed families that effectively run the Federal Reserve System and then loan us all of the printed dollars of America, loan it to us at interest, inherently creating debt. Why would we allow this? Why? How could we allow this to happen? And when you look at the system, the federal banks, the central banks, these bastards that are running these systems can print all, there's trillions of dollars missing. Trillions. Can you imagine if you could print all the money that you wanted, it's just paper for you? You could then buy anyone who can be bought. And unfortunately, within the human race, we have a lot of very corrupt and nasty people. But they also happen to be quite talented. So, those are the people inherently that get the positions of power. It's not the people who are noble and who have integrity who are going to reach high places of power unless they do it on their own right, in their own path, which is not easy. I can speak from experience. But if you have a corrupt nature, if you're willing to be bought, then you will be rewarded with plenty of money. And part of the system, the way that functions, is the central banking system, the Federal Reserve, and so on and so forth. Anyway, I started to realize after I got out of the Marine Corps, the day that I was discharged from the Marine Corps is the happiest day of my life. I vowed that I would never give up my freedom again and that I would exercise my freedom to the hilt. I realized how stupid I was to give up my freedom and put myself in a position to kill or be killed based on wars that have nothing to do with making America a better or safer place. After I got out of the Marine Corps, I commenced to a serious course of independent study. I started to read books like Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, a fantastic book if you want to understand the history of how we've treated the Native Americans. I read Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. Again, I can use that as an example of where somebody can go to high school and university and go through years of history and learning about the United States and come out quite stupid. And yet you could read that one book and understand more about American history than most do. And of course, that's not a book that's in the programs at our public schools, is it? So these books made me realize that I had been lied to my whole life along with all of the American people. Important information was omitted that was very important for me to understand why we have these problems that we do today, both inside and outside of America. And as I started to learn these things, you know, it made me angry. I make no apologies for that. It made me very angry. But it also motivated me. It motivated me to learn more. Eventually, as this continued, I got a lot of the tattoos. Many of them are covered up today, but I've got a lot of these tattoos, and they all have a deep meaning to me. each one is a form of expression and also a form of commitment. You know, this one on my neck, for instance, means compassion for all life. I've thought about these tattoos, and I've thought about, you know, is this something that you really know? Is this a real conviction that you know you will die with? And if I don't feel that way, then I haven't gotten any such tattoo. And part of the reason why I've done that is because when I was younger, I had a lot of convictions. And as I've already said, I was an idiot. I realized those convictions were completely stupid and based on false information. So compassion for all life. If I die somehow reversing myself on this, then something's gone terribly wrong. I believe in compassion for all life, not just human life, all life. And so I started to realize, you know, that I had this real need to kind of make my own path. And the tattoos and alternative information led me down a course of direct action. I believed in direct action big time. I've been involved in direct actions both in marine conservation and in the political forum, whether it be opposing nuclear testing in Nevada or also obviously with Palestine and then the Human Shield Action, which I initiated back in 2003. I believe in direct action to the hilt. I believe that in combination with things like the BDS, the boycott, divestment, sanction campaigns and protesting and petitions and all of the grassroots work that can be done, this is all very important that we combine all these things. But I don't believe anything has more power than direct action, especially when it's done with intelligence, discipline, a relative scale, a certain amount of scale, and a healthy dose of fearlessness. I don't believe anything is more important than direct action. And I don't believe anything can accelerate the process of consciousness, of growing consciousness, more than direct action. And I would say, and I will get into it more, that the flotilla helps establish that fact. I was on the first Free Gaza boats, as mentioned in that film, and that was a beautiful, beautiful time to sail into Gaza for the first time in 41 years, to sail in and have tens of thousands of Palestinians, which I'm sure there would have been hundreds of thousands, except most of them didn't think we were going to make it. And to sail in on that day and to feel the euphoria and the joy in that very desperate place for just one day was a tremendous blessing. But it was just one day and a very temporary respite. And obviously, the task of freeing the Palestinians is far from over. I ended up leaving the Free Gaza mission. To be honest, and I really don't want to get too much into the politics and the things that happen on the inside, but I'll get into it only so much as I feel I need to try and share some of my experiences in order for us to try and avoid some of what I see as the silliness and the politics and the egos that I believe are holding us back tremendously. I left Free Gaza because there were some internal differences, shall we say. As a captain myself, I had a very different outlook as to what a captain's responsibilities are from as compared to an organizer. And I understand what it is to organize direct action, but I also know that a captain has responsibilities. And I was actually the first captain to volunteer to say that I would actually travel into Gaza, because you don't generally find captains willing to do such things. You know. Anyway, when I got to Gaza, the boats were turning back within 4 days, and I just didn't want to do that. I worked for a long time to try to get into Gaza, and although my wife was pregnant at the time, I really did not want to leave right then and there. And so most everybody left, and I was there with a few people, and after about a week or so, it was time to head back. So I went to Rafah, and wouldn't you know it, but the Egyptians wouldn't let us out. And I'm grateful for that as well. I'm a big practitioner in turning negatives into positives, so when I realized that the Egyptians were going to keep me from visiting or going back home to reunite with my pregnant wife, I thought, well, okay, well, then I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure you regret sticking me here. And that's when I came up with Aloha Palestine. Aloha and Palestine, if you're wondering where that comes from, having lived in Hawaii for many years, having been to Palestine several times, there is this amazing similarity. The people of Hawaii are beautiful, beautiful people. They're amongst the most generous, friendly, hospitable people you'll ever meet. And most people who go to Hawaii never actually experience real Hawaii, I can assure you, but I have. And it is a tremendous, tremendous attribute, quality to the Hawaiian people. They're very beautiful people. The Palestinians are exactly the same in their own way, despite the fact that they have been brutalized for decades and demoralized and treated in such horrendous ways. They have not lost who they are. They are a beautiful, generous, hospitable people. And if you ever visit Palestine, I can assure you, you will experience what I'm talking about. Just the fact that an American can walk any street in Gaza or any street in the West Bank and actually be looked after and shepherded and treated so beautifully. Think about that. If the same crime had been committed against the American people, the same level of crime, can you imagine if anyone from the place where the person who were persecuting us, if anybody came from, can you imagine some of the people who live in our society, what they would do to that person if they were walking on one of our streets? Think about that. The Palestinians are remarkable in the fact that they have maintained their humanity. They have not become the angry, violent, nasty, vicious, vendetta, prone type of people. They are just simply doing their best to get on in a very, very difficult circumstance. And that is Aloha and Palestine. They're one and the same. And that was my focus. Now, I wasn't even planning on going on the flotilla. That's the truth. I've been working every day on Aloha Palestine. That was my focus. But I realized, once I saw the IHH, the Turkish, get on board and get these ships, when I saw that, I thought, well, I didn't initially, but eventually, about 3 weeks before it left, I gotta go. Because I knew that the flotilla was gonna make it into Gaza. I knew it. I was on the first Free Gaza mission. There was two boats, 46 people. We managed to sail in. So I really, really, really believed that we were going to make it in on that flotilla. So I talked to one of my friends who was going on the Mavi Marmara. And I told him, look, can you ask the leaders, I'd like to come. And very fortunately, they knew who I was, and they thought well of me, unlike some. And they let me on at the last minute. And all the way up to the morning of the attack, I can tell you, I did not think that the Israelis were going to attack. I'm happy to admit I was completely wrong, more than wrong. Anyway, while we were on the ship, you know, I didn't know hardly anybody, really, of the Turks. I didn't really know anybody. And there were a few Westerners, but not too many. It was quite a mix of people. You know, we had Arabs and we had Asians from Malaysia and Indonesia. And we had some Europeans, but mostly Turkish, Arabs, Asians. And it was an amazing mix of people. It was definitely an influence, quite a heavy influence of Islam, which, you know, for those who haven't actually spent time within Muslim communities, I have. And, you know, all of these characterizations, negative characterizations of Muslims is just, again, horribly unfair. Of course, there are fanatical people who call themselves Muslims, just as there are Christians and Jews, but the vast majority of Muslims are very, very, in fact, I'd say much more consistent with the tenets of what I consider to be real religion, which is all based effectively on the golden rule. It's that simple. If your religion allows you to do something differently to someone else than you would have done to you, then that's a false religion. A real religion applies the golden rule, and I see most Muslims that I have dealt with in the communities that I have visited as really good and decent people. And that was the kind of people you found on the ship, and even to a higher level. These are people that were very committed to the cause. One of the things that was so beautiful about being on that ship, and noticeably absent in the Western direct actions that I have been on, not always, but for the most part, is the lack of politics, the lack of gossip, the lack of infighting that I have seen time and time and time again. And it's not just, you know, it's not just things that I've seen with myself. I have witnessed, you know, other people in the fighting. And if you haven't seen that, then I'm wondering how much direct action you've done, because I think most of us here, if you've been involved in activist circles, can acknowledge there's a little bit too much game playing going on here. And it really diminishes our capacity to do good when we're sitting there arguing with each other about this, that, or the other. There was a complete lack of that on the Turkish ship. They had leaders. Those leaders were respected. They carried themselves in a very noble way. They were very intelligent. And when it came down to the attack, they were right there with the rest of us who were defending the ship. When things need to get done, they just get done. And I really love this type of environment. I had the same experience in working with the Hawaiians for years. I started in that process of working with the Hawaiian independence movement coming out of nowhere. So when the Hawaiians saw me coming, they thought, what the hell is this white boy doing here? And I don't blame them, given the fact that it was us white folk that came and stole their land, all the while telling them how they're heathens and adopt our religion and abandon your culture and so on and so forth. So that legacy continues. But over the course of years, I developed the kind of relationship whereby the respect was absolute and totally mutual. And what I saw throughout my experience in the Hawaiian independence movement was the same thing. There were leaders and there were workers. When the work needed to be done, the work got done. There was not this bickering and stuff that I've seen elsewhere. I love those types of environments, really, when people just get down to it. There's a job that needs to be done. Let's do it. Now, on the flotilla, I was a worker, just a worker, nothing more, nothing less. And I actually really enjoy that job because having been a leader and having been a worker, I can tell you for sure, being a worker is easy in comparison. You know, what do I need to do? Pick up some trash? Fine, I'll pick up the trash. What do you need? You need that done? Fine, I'll get that done. The organizer has a million different things going on. And, I've done that job, and I'm capable of doing that job, but I'm quite fine being the worker bee. And that's all I was. When I got to the ship, there was this beautiful environment. It was a beautiful environment. The question that was asked repeatedly was, why are you here? Which I found to be really almost amusing in a way, because my answer to the question was, given the fact that we live in such a horribly unjust world with so many unacceptable realities going on, thinking about all of the people who want to feel engaged, how do we make this world a better place? What can I do? I mean, these are questions I hear all the time. I could not think of any better place than to be on that ship at that time, confronting this blockade, this horrible crime being perpetrated against the Palestinian people. Where else would I be? And I think basically everybody felt the same way. And so we were heading towards Gaza in a very, very positive and constructive light. And, we started to get close to disputably territorial waters. We were about 74 miles out to sea when the attack came. And I swear, all the way up to the very moment of the attack, I had people coming up to me saying, they're going to attack. No, they're not. Don't worry about it. And, obviously that wasn't the case. Now, if you're wondering how we set about defending the ship and whatnot, I didn't really know anything of the plans until a day before we were attacked. And on that day, I was asked, would I be filming, taking pictures, or did I want to defend the ship? And, given my experience, I know I have certain abilities. I thought, of course, I will help to defend the ship. I also didn't think that we would need to, but nonetheless, if it was needed, then I would contribute in that way. There were plenty of photographers and videographers, so this is something that I could do. We were put into 6-person teams, and each team had a leader and a second in command. I was actually made second in command, and there was a Turkish man who was in charge of us. We were specifically told, in fact, before we even boarded the ship, we were told no knives of any kind. I had a little paring knife with a blade about that big that I actually left back in Antalya in Turkey because I knew we weren't supposed to have any knives. We were thoroughly checked, like airline type check, going through the machine and having our baggage checked before we got on that ship. There were no weapons. Cooking knives do not qualify as weapons. When we're starting to get close, we were put in these 6-person teams, and Myself, I was on a team at the back portion of the ship, and there were various teams set at different parts of the ship. Lo and behold, at 3:40 in the morning, now keep in mind, the Israelis were saying, they were shocked. We didn't know that they were going to be doing this. We thought that it was going to be simple boarding and da-da-da-da-da. That's what they were saying. The Israelis are really quite remarkable liars. They're fully capable of lying about virtually anything, and this is just one of many lies. The IHH leadership had been saying on international television for a long time leading up to the departure that the Turkish element of the flotilla would defend the ship with their bodies. It was made emphatically clear, if the Israelis want us to believe that they thought there would be no resistance, then we will have to conclude that they are a bunch of idiots who didn't even bother to watch international television news programs in which the leader of IHH said that we would defend the ship. So, the Israelis claimed that they were shocked. They weren't shocked. They knew full well that there would be resistance. They attacked at 3:40 in the morning. They timed it to the morning prayers. That was no accident as well. Again, if they thought there would be no resistance, then why are you coming at 3:40 in the morning? And why are you coming with 10 to 12 Zodiac boats loaded with commandos and helicopters and firing percussion grenades, smoke bombs, tear gas, firing paintball rounds and live rounds from the very beginning? Because that is what was happening. We were being attacked from the very first moment. In fact, the first person to die was a photographer. This man, father of two, was holding his camera and never held any weapon at all. And he was shot when he was taking his camera and pointing it up at a helicopter. And he was shot right between the eyes. He was the first one that I saw dead. At a certain point, as I was running around the deck of the ship, I saw him lying on the ground. And I knelt down to start taking his pulse, not realizing, and someone else said, look, pointed to his head, at which point I saw that he had been shot in the head and was obviously gone. So before I had any contact with any of the commandos, we knew on that ship that we were being attacked. And they were going for a photographer to start. So the message there was, obviously, they did not want people shooting video or shooting pictures of what they were about to do. I saw one of the helicopters come over the middle of the ship over the top deck, and I basically abandoned my post. I told the man in charge of me, I'm going to go up there because clearly there's a problem there. They were trying to board from the Zodiacs, but we were effective in repelling them. We threw things at them. I actually didn't throw anything. Funny enough, at one point, right at the very beginning, one of my brothers threw something, and I said, don't throw anything. I still kind of thought there was a civil way to deal with this. And, I was beyond wrong on all levels here. Anyway, they couldn't get up with the Zodiac, so they brought the helicopter in, and that's hovering over the top. And they started fast roping down. A lot of people get this wrong. They were not rappelling. Rappelling requires you to hook onto a rope, and then you have to unhook from it. When you fast rope, you just grab it with your hands and with gloves and your feet, and you can just slide down like that, and then when you hit the bottom, you're off. I know because I've done this when I was in the Marines, and I could see that they were getting onto the ship rather quickly. As I went up to the second deck, the deck below the top deck, as if, you know, it were scripted, one of the commandos was pushed over the top and fell down virtually 2-3 feet in front of me. The first thing I saw as that commando fell to the ground was he had a 9mm pistol, and I immediately descended upon him to grab that pistol. I unhinged it. I took that pistol away from him, and one of the other brothers was able to take him inside, and then he was taken by the rest of the people. Now, I had that pistol in my hand with him right in front of me, and I can assure you, having military experience, that it would have been as easy as taking that off of safety, pointing it right at his head, and his life would have been ended right then and there. So the accusation that we were intent on killing anyone is beyond farcical. If we wanted to kill, we would have killed several of them without any problem. If we were killers, it would have been the easiest thing in the world to do. So this is one of the many lies that has been told by the Israelis. I had this pistol in my hand for a good 5 minutes, and I can say the only reason why I'm here today is one of two primary possibilities. One, the Israelis had orders not to kill white people, which is distinctly possible. I would not doubt that, and it would be a wise move on their behalf. If you notice, Furkan Dogan, the American citizen of Turkish citizenship as well, is continually referred to as Turkish. This is no accident. This is a free pass by your so-called media in the United States to try and hide the fact that an American citizen, 19 years old, was executed by the Israelis with 3 shots to the head at point-blank range, a shot to the back, and a shot to the leg. This young man was taking pictures and never had any weapon at all, and he was executed on the top deck. So this is the kind of thing that was happening as after the first commando, I was running around that ship with that gun, not knowing what to do with it. If I wanted to use it, I could have used it. I didn't want to use it. I just thought it was evidence, and we needed to put it somewhere safe in the hopes that there would be a trial and that we could use this as evidence. I went around the ship for a good 5 minutes, and I guess if they didn't have orders not to kill white people, then I am one hell of a lucky man, because to be running around that ship with snipers who had laser-guided sniper rifles running around both on the helicopters and on the top deck. Many of the people that were killed by commandos who were on the top deck and firing down on the deck that I was on for quite some time. So how I'm even here, I'm not sure, other than I'm extremely lucky, or they had orders not to kill us white folk. At a certain point, not being able to figure out who to give this thing to, I eventually took the bullets out of the weapon. They were real bullets. And I took the weapon, and I hit it and handed the bullets to some of the other people on board. As I finished that, I came back out to the other side on the second deck, and lo and behold, another commando fell right out from the sky right in front of me. This one had a submachine gun, not a paintball gun, a submachine gun, and I do know the difference. This one was much more alert and active and was trying to get to his weapon in order to fire it. I immediately descended upon him and started grabbing at his hands while another brother started to try and grab that weapon. We struggled with him for probably a good 20 seconds trying to get his hands pried off of that thing. And eventually I was successful in pulling his hands off, and the brother unslinged it and took that weapon away. He later told me that he threw it into the sea. We had that machine gun, and I can assure you, if we wanted to kill any of the Israeli commandos, we could have killed them. Now, I don't say this as if you should think, oh, wow, you guys are really nice. I'm not saying we're really nice people and all that, but the fact is that we did what we were needed to do in order to defend ourselves and that mission. And let me get into what I think about that. There are a lot of people, and I know in liberal left circles, there are a lot of people who believe in pacifism and who believe that never is there an excuse to use violence, even in self-defense. I have a heavy respect for that, especially if it's in line with what Gandhi talked about, and I think people don't understand Gandhi very well. To quote Gandhi, and I'll give you the whole context, but here is a direct quote from Gandhi: "Between cowardice and violence, I would advise violence." Now, if anybody wants to dispute me on this, I'm happy to challenge you. Those are his direct words. Gandhi: "I would advise violence." Now, what he meant by that was, the context of it is that when you say you believe in nonviolence, okay, fair enough. But if you're using nonviolence as a cover to run over here when the problem is over there, that's not nonviolence, that's cowardice. If you really believe in nonviolence and you're a very staunch advocate, if the problem is there, then you take your nonviolence and you face it square on, and you be prepared to die or lose your freedom. That is nonviolence. Big difference from cowardice, which talks about nonviolence, but when it comes to our responsibility for perpetuating mass murder, we are hypocrites. We are beyond hypocritical. If we paid a hitman to go kill somebody, would we be any less guilty than the hitman themselves? No, of course we wouldn't. Yet, we in the West, and it's not just us in the United States, and this is part of the reason why I can be extremely unpopular, and I will never back down, nor will I stop telling the truth. I don't care how much it irritates people to hear the truth, because the truth is essential if we're going to have a better world. And the truth is that while people are being slaughtered in mass in Iraq and Afghanistan, while we're protesting it and while we're signing petitions, we are also paying for it. We are paying for it. We are paying for the mass murder the war crimes and the crimes against humanity. And it may not be pleasant to acknowledge that, but it's a fact nonetheless. Now, I know a lot of people do things like I did and start your own business and collect money for yourself, and that's an easy way to stop paying taxes. But the bottom line is, I believe in nonviolence to the point that I did refuse to pay taxes for many years. I did not fill out my tax forms. I was threatened by the police. I had bench warrants issued for my arrest. I went into U.S. courts and challenged them and tried my best to get them to reveal the fact that we are not operating under constitutional law. I've done all these things. I formally renounced my U.S. citizenship on March 1st, 2001, and said explicitly in writing to the U.S. State Department that I had not paid taxes for years, nor would I, and I would prefer go to prison than ever pay one penny for the murder of my brothers and sisters halfway around the world, and listed a whole bunch of other reasons why. So I believe in nonviolence, absolutely. But under certain circumstances, there is absolutely nothing wrong with using violence to defend yourself. And in our case, I go a bit further. We weren't just defending ourselves. As far as I'm concerned, those people in Palestine, those are my family. Now, I renounced my U.S. citizenship, as I've said. I'm actually an Irish citizen. I have an Irish passport, and I'm very happy with that. I'm a Hawaiian national as well. I am a Hawaiian citizen. There was a Hawaiian nation, and there is a Hawaiian citizenship base. I am a Hawaiian citizen. I am also a Palestinian. I have been given citizenship, effectively naturalized. Now, if you know somebody who is not originally from the United States, who may have came here from any other country, whether it's, you know, Asia or in the Asian continent or somewhere else, if they came here and naturalized and became an American citizen, I don't think there are too many people in this room who would say, oh, well, you're not an American citizen. Of course you are. Because you're white or because you're born here does not mean that you're a U.S. citizen in itself. Citizenship is allegiance. My allegiance is to the Hawaiian nation and to the Hawaiian people and to their government. My allegiance is to the Palestinian people and to their government, whatever it may be that they choose. That is where my allegiance is. And as far as I'm concerned, that is my family over there. And I don't care if not one ounce of Palestinian blood is coursing through my veins. That is my family. So when I see my family, 1.5 million in Gaza and 800,000 plus children being tormented while we are doing little to stop it, I see a need to go a step further. And on that particular day where we were attacked, I would have preferred much more for us not to be attacked and to simply sail into Gaza. But since the Israelis had attacked us, then we were damn well right to do what we did. And I really take issue with people who will sit there and point the finger and say that we somehow did something wrong by defending ourselves. The only way you can see it that way is if you don't see those people as your family. Because our mission was inherently intended to benefit those people over there in Gaza. And those family members needed our help. So I liken it to somebody invading your home. If someone came into your home and was threatening your family and was killing your family, what would you do? If you see it that way, then you understand exactly what we did on that evening. And when we had an opportunity to kill the people that were murdering our people, we did not. We gave them medical attention and we released them. We didn't have to do that. And I have to say, I didn't even necessarily agree with the decision. We had three of those commandos who looked like little frightened children. All the bravado and all the swagger and all that went right out the window when they were disarmed and taken downstairs. They looked at us like we were them. And since they were killers, they thought we would do to them what they were doing to us. They thought we were going to kill them. And you could see it in them. They were little frightened children. All of it gone. Cowards, quite frankly. And we did the right thing. We let them go. Now, you can imagine in those circumstances, there was a man there from Lebanon in 2006. He lost his entire family. He went home and his home was destroyed. Four of his children, wife, gone. Like that. In an instant. The Israelis did that to his family. So you can imagine how this man felt seeing more people die. There was a man, father of six, who died in his wife's arms, bleeding to death. There were people who had gunshot wounds all over the place. There was blood everywhere. We were overwhelmed. There was no way we could handle this type of attack And it was a combat situation in which we were not combat armed. And yet, I say that it was a tremendous blessing and an honor to be there. I am proud to have stood shoulder to shoulder, especially with my Turkish brothers and sisters. I love the Turkish people. They are strong. And their government has, I think, a healthy dose of fear of them, whereas the American government and European governments have no fear of our populations. And I think the honor that you see exhibited by the Turkish government is actually a representation or a reflection of the will of the Turkish people, who are prepared to do whatever it takes to help free their Palestinian brothers and sisters. So despite the fact that this was a great tragedy, I haven't met any of the family members of the fallen, but I suspect that when I do, they will say that they don't regret what's happened, but of course they long for the loved ones that they've left behind or who have left them behind. The treatment from when we eventually the order came down from the captain to stop resisting, the Israelis had taken over the bridge at that point. On the bridge, the chief engineer had his wife and a one-year-old baby was on that ship. And when the commandos came in, guns at the ready, pointed at the crew, they ordered the captain to stop the ship. He refused, and one of the commandos took the gun and pointed it right at the baby, which was in his mother's arms, and at that point ordered him again to stop the ship, at which point he did follow the order. But you can imagine how it felt holding your one-year-old baby to have an Israeli commando, probably one of the ones or possibly one of the ones who was murdering others, pointing a gun at your baby. The treatment we had was despicable, and yet probably a day at the beach compared to what Palestinians deal with on a daily basis. We were lied to continuously, over and over again. We were surrendering one by one to the Israeli commandos, hands on our head. We were cuffed, and some of us, myself included, were kicked and punched while we were handcuffed and taken up to the decks, the top deck and a deck below, and put in stress positions and made to wait for about 12 hours in that position before we were brought into the ship. This was May, and hot Mediterranean sun. There were older people, you know, many your age, older, 50, 60, even 70 years old. Imagine hanging out in the hot sun, no food, no water. One man, an elderly man, asked to use the toilet repeatedly and was not allowed to use the toilet. Eventually, he had to pee in his pants because they weren't allowing him to do that. And the standard thing was, you know, as an Israeli is holding a gun like this, he would just conveniently stand here like this while the gun's sitting there pointing at your head, which is not a very comfortable position to be in, and it's clearly just a form of intimidation and just shows the total lack of professionalism or decency. Men who had appearances of being Muslim were treated different from others. The younger men with beards and whatnot were given a little extra dose of Israeli hospitality. And we transported to Ashdod port. Once we got there, it was a long process of offloading and going through processing stations, at which point they gathered up who you were. Now, I had my Irish passport and my Palestinian passport. I hid my Irish passport on the ship and handed over my Palestinian passport when I arrived. I'm the only one that did this, and I can assure you it won me lots of favor with the Israelis when I gave them the Palestinian passport. Of course, the same old types of things that everybody was experiencing were then amplified on me. Continually, they would stare at you. You can just stare at you like you're the biggest piece of crap they've ever seen, and you can just feel the scorn and scowl. And for a lot of people, understandably, this is very intimidating, and eventually, you know, people look down and kind of act submissive or just avoid any kind of eye contact. I just happen to be one of those crazy son of a bitches who doesn't respond to that kind of stuff very well, and I don't like bullies at all. And I know for sure that if I were Arab, I would be dead by now, because I do things that a Palestinian simply could not do. And when they would look at me, I would look right back at them with every bit as much scorn as they gave me. And I wouldn't look down. And so it's not really so much of a surprise that eventually I got beaten. But that didn't happen on the ship. That happened after we arrived in the jail, spent a day or two there, 2 days there. And then we were transported to Ben Gurion Airport. Now myself, I refused to sign anything. Many did. I think most refused to sign. But also refused to voluntarily be deported and was disputing that. And I actually tried to get more people to say, come on, let's have a healthy group of people here who refuse to go, because I knew that the last thing they wanted was for us to be in jail for any protracted period of time. And I also wanted to get it on record, you know. You're the ones that kidnapped us, killed us, took us to a place we didn't ask to come to, and then deport us from the place we never asked to come to. So I wanted it in writing, I wanted it on record, and refused to go. As it turns out, the Turkish had decided that they were going to go en masse, so that pretty much took everybody. And the treatment was just oh so pleasant that most people didn't want to stay that much longer, so everybody basically left. And I found myself with one other brother who stuck with me on this, and it was the two of us, an Irishman, coincidentally. And everybody was taken out of the jail, and all the Turkish, I can tell you, as they were leaving and we were left behind, I could see they felt bad about it. But don't worry about it, you know. Love and respect, we'll see you soon. And they all gave us hugs, and then it was just me and my Irish brother, Fiacra is his name, and I looked at him, I said, boy, this is going to be interesting. And there we were, two of us, and I don't know, 50, 100 Israeli guards in this jail complex set up for us. And as it turns out, what they did was they carted everybody out to the transport buses, and then once they got everybody there, they just came and got us. And we went out to the buses last. So while they were sitting out in the buses in the hot sun, we stayed in the jail and lied down in bed until it was time to go. So that was a lie, you know. They said, yeah, okay, fine, you refuse to go, you'll be able to go see a judge. So we got transported to the airport, and we got to the airport, and the dynamics of this was really interesting. We had one guy who was clearly in charge in civilian clothes. I mean, you know, he identified himself as the one in charge, and clearly he was in charge. And then you had all these special police in like dark blue, black uniforms that were there at the airport, and they hated us, boy. And my friend Fiacra, I'm not like him. If somebody doesn't mess with me, then I, and in fact, you know, I've come here, I've been interrogated coming in this U.S. I went out, the Canadians asked me all the questions. I came back after a day in Canada, again, I get asked all the questions. And I always treat people respectfully. But if you disrespect me, then I don't care what you do. I'm not going to treat you in a way that you're not willing to treat me. And I don't care whether you have a badge and a gun. It makes no difference to me. And so I'm polite, believe it or not, unless somebody's really doing something. My friend Fiacre was just the royal pain in the ass. He really was. Every step of the way, he was like trying to antagonize them. And what I saw, and it was really funny in many ways, was this guy in charge who's just like, you could tell he just wanted to just fucking smack him and lock him out, but yet he had to be civil and had to try and deal with it. And then you could see the police, and they were just like ready, man. They were just chomping at the bits, wanting. And of course they were looking at me and I was looking at them and all this kind of stuff. Eventually they took us up to near the terminal, and a man, Paul LaRudy, an American who's crazy as well. When the Israelis attacked the boat that he was on, he jumped in the water and they pulled him out of the water and beat him up. He had a black eye and he had bruises on his arms and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, he was handcuffed and about maybe 20, 30 feet in front of us, and there was maybe 20, 30 of us total, mostly Turkish, myself and Fiacra. And they told him something and wanted to take him somewhere he didn't want to go. And he sat down on the ground and they started to manhandle him, and he started screaming in pain. And we all stood up and started protesting verbally. One thing led to another. The police came and one of them whacked me over the head with a baton, and it didn't do anything to me. I mean, you might as well just flick me in the head like that. It just didn't even feel it. But it caused like an inch and a half gash in my forehead, and blood was just streaming down everywhere. Rule number one in public relations, if you want to brutalize people, don't hit them on the head. It makes a lot of blood, and it really bad. Hit them somewhere else, the ribs much better, back, all that kind of stuff. And so I'm bleeding all over the place, at which point now I'm yelling expletives and telling them what a bunch of cowards they are in my loudest voice possible. And it turns into a real melee, and one of the commandos then gets me into a headlock. I'm not resisting physically, but I'm expressing myself very effectively, I think. And I was put into a headlock. I was completely incapable of breathing, and I'm an ex-free diver. I used to be able to hold my breath for quite a long time, and he was holding me in this position for quite some time. I was kicked and punched in the ribs, and I was within a few seconds of blacking out, and that was the only time during this whole process that I actually thought, I don't know if I'm actually going to make this one. I was thinking about the guy who was in charge as I was getting close to blacking out and thinking, I'd really like for you to come back over here and sort this one out, because I'm not so sure that your man here is going to actually stop. And I went limp a couple of seconds, a few seconds before I would have blacked out. And he did release me, obviously. Because I had blood everywhere and I refused at that point, and then after a bit they said they wanted to give me some medical attention. I told them to piss off, basically. And so I had blood everywhere, and everybody flew out on that day, and I ended up spending two more days back, I suppose because they didn't want me flying back with blood all over me. And so I was held for a couple extra days. Now, in that process, I was still refusing to go, yet I think I was either the last one or one of the very last ones. There were some in the hospital, but I don't know of anybody else who was still there. There may have been a couple of Turkish that they held a little bit longer as well. But I was one of the very few that was there anyway. And I did actually get to go see a judge. It was completely farcical. I was given 5 minutes notice. Okay, the judge will see you now. I haven't seen an attorney. I don't have anything to prepare, but okay. I went and saw a judge. He asked me some questions. I volunteered information. He said he'd make his decision in a half hour. He made the decision. Yeah, you're going to be deported, da-da-da-da. So that happened, and the night before I left, I was attacked once more in the cell. A couple of guys came in and roughed me up a bit and then went out. I had wiped my face by that point. Now I had blood all over my face again. And the next day, they said they were sending me out regardless. And I wasn't agreeing to go voluntarily or anything like that, but they said they were going to let me. They were going to send me. And you're going to need to wash your face. I said, no, I'm not washing my face. Anyway, the Irish consul and the Irish ambassador begged me to wipe my face. And I said, no, I'm not going to wipe my face. And the reason why I'm not going to wipe my face is because I came here with the intention of going to Gaza. I came here with a bunch of personal equipment, which has been stolen from me. I came here, all of my human rights have been violated, along with all of my other brothers and sisters. You know, the only thing I have left is my bloody clothes and my bloody face, and I'm going to damn well keep it. And, well, they told me, you're not going to go. I said, well, I guess I'm not going then. And they were desperate enough to get rid of me that they actually let me get on the plane looking a bloody mess. And I can assure you, from my perspective, I did feel a bit silly. Here I am getting on a Turkish Airlines plane, put in first class. The Turkish treated us all very well. So here I am sitting in first class. I'm the first one on the plane. And everyone comes on the plane, and here I am. Blood-stained clothes everywhere, face filled with blood, and I had to smile, and I realized this is a bit silly, but the whole point of that was, you know, when I did arrive, I didn't know if anybody would be at the airport or not, really. I mean, I hadn't any contact, so I couldn't possibly know. But, you know, as it turns out, when I did land in Turkey, of course, pictures were taken, it's one of the pieces of evidence that we have that we were brutalized, you know, and as silly as it felt doing it, there was a purpose for it. And I think, you know, this is kind of the way that we have to be as activists. You know, you have to look at every situation. You have to be aware. You have to make the most and exploit every opportunity we get. And in that particular case, it was something to exploit. And it does have some value in the big picture. So, anyway, that was my experience. Now, what happened was, 2 days after I was released, The IDF then issued a press release, and in the press release they identified five terrorists, and one of the five happens to be me. They named me specifically, and they said that I am, quote, a terrorist operative of Hamas, and that I was traveling to Gaza to train a commando unit for Hamas. I'm not making this up, and I've taken a screenshot of it, but it's still online right now. I have been officially accused of being a terrorist by the IDF. Now, there have been journalists that have made inquiries as to whether or not they could provide any proof, and of course, the same old tired excuse, security, is being used to deny any kind of access to information that would give any kind of evidence to support this claim. And you've seen Aloha Palestine. Now, maybe I'm a very clever con man, and I'm just actually intending to run some weapons into Gaza under the guise of safe trade. That could be possible, I suppose, if you didn't know me. But if you did know me, you'd know that as much as I believe in the right of self-defense, I also believe in being intelligent. And I cannot imagine any way that the Palestinians are going to win a battle of arms with the Israelis. It just isn't going to happen. If any kind of liberation is going to occur, it's not going to be by the gun. And although I understand and actually can see value in some of the violent tactics that have been used by the Palestinians, I think we have reached a time, finally, where after decades of being ignored, they do not need to use violence as a means of attracting attention. In fact, Hamas said in the aftermath of the flotilla that the flotilla did more than firing 10,000 rockets into Gaza. That's an important acknowledgement, and it's true, and I agree with it. So I don't have any interest in running guns into Gaza, nor training commando units. It's pretty laughable. I haven't been in the Marine Corps for 20 years, and if anyone were to do the training, I'm sure Hamas could train me, not the other way around. Nonetheless, this is a serious charge. Arabs who are accused of being terrorists can be executed and are executed, as we saw in Dubai. Not that long ago, a Mossad hit team was sent to take someone out. For the rest of my life, I will, especially as long as I continue to speak about my experiences, and especially if you understand the Israeli psyche, it is deeply embarrassing that we actually disarmed some of their people, really, and had complete control of them. This is not actually very well known in Israel. In fact, they're kind of going under the assumption that their boys effectively escaped, you know, or never actually got taken. And it's because it hurts them deeply to know that their best, their very best unit, three of them, were at our mercy, at our whim, and we let them go. You know, I'm a father. I have a beautiful wife, and I love my son deeply. I love my family, and I would like to live. I certainly intend to stick around as long as I can. But I have long since accepted the fact that I could very well lose my freedom and possibly my life. This experience has happened for a reason, and I have the ability, the strength, and the will to do whatever I can to try and support this cause, and I find myself in this position, I reckon, because I'm meant to be in it. That's where I'm at. That's my path. If I continue to be blessed as I have been, and I have been so blessed in my life, from having such a beautiful mother who raised me with the kind of love and values that I've tried to pass on, to the many blessings I've had with my Palestinian brothers and sisters, my Iraqi brothers and sisters, my Hawaiian brothers and sisters, my Turkish brothers and sisters, and my Western brothers and sickers. Brothers and sisters, what happened there? I've been a very, very blessed man, and if I were to die tomorrow, no one should cry an extra tear for me. I have lived my life believing in certain values and acting on those values. To me, there's no tragedy in that. The great tragedy in life is not doing what you believe to be right, being afraid to do what you believe is right. That is tragic. So I thank you all very much for your time.